Ladies and gentlemen, in the first part of my talk, I give a report on the discovery of LSD. I realize it is a very, very old story, and I must apologize for repeating it here. But as so many quite fantastic versions how LSD has been discovered, are current leading in professional circles, I think you would like to hear also the true story. Ladies and gentlemen, in the first part of my talk, I give a report on the discovery of LSD. I realize it is a very, very old story, and I must apologize for repeating it here. But since so many quite fantastic versions how LSD has been discovered are current even in professional circles, I think you would like to hear also the true story. It is often stated in the literature that LSD was discovered by chance. The following account will show that LSD was not the fruit of a chance discovery, but the outcome of a more complex process that had its beginnings in a definite concept and was followed up by appropriate experiments during the course of which a chance observation served on to trigger off a planned investigation, which then led to the actual discovery. Such a train of events often underlies what is said to be a chance discovery. I prepared lysergic acid, diethylamide, for the first time in 1938 as part of a systematic chemical and pharmacological investigation on ergot alkaloids in the Sandoz Pharmaceutical Chemical Research Laboratories in Basel, headed at that time by Professor Arthur Stoll. For a better understanding of the following account, some background information about ergot is needed. Ergot is produced by a lower fungus, by Claviceps purpurea, that grows parasitically on rye, but also on other species of grain and on wild grasses. This is the first picture. It will be nothing new for you. Everybody knows what that means. These protrusions coming out of the grain are named ergot. The kernels infested with the fungus develop in this light brown to purple brown curved pecs to sclerotia in place of the normal grains. Ergot is described botanically as a sclerotium. That is the form of the ergot fungus that passes the winter. Ergot has, more than any other drug, a fascinating history, in the course of which its role and meaning has inverted. Once dreaded as a poison, in the course of time it has changed to a rich storehouse of valuable medicaments. Ergot first appeared in history in the early Middle Ages as a cause of epidemic-like outbreaks of mass poisonings, to which thousands of men at times fell victim. The illness whose connection with ergot was for a long time obscure appeared in two characteristic forms, as a gangrenous form, ergotismus gangrenosus, and a convulsive form, ergotismus convulsivus. Designations to the disease such as Mal des Ardents, Ignis Sacer, Heiliges Feuer, or St. Anthony's Fire, refer to the gangrenous form of ergotism. The patron saint of ergotism victim was St. Anthony. Next slide, please. And it was the order of St. Anthony that above all undertook care of these patients. Here you see St. Anthony surrounded by patients with ergotism. Epidemic-like occurrences of ergot poisoning have been recorded in most European countries and also in certain areas of Russia. With improvement in agriculture and since the understanding that was attained in the 17th century that ergot-containing bread was a cause of ergotism, the frequency and extent of ergotism epidemics diminished considerably. The last great epidemic occurred in certain areas of southern Russia in the years 1926 to 27. The first mention of a medicinal application of ergot, namely as an ecbolic, that means a medicament accelerating childbirth, is found in the herbal of the Frankfurt city physician Adam Lonitzer from the year 1582. Also ergot, as in the above citation, was used since olden times by midwives. It was not until 1808 that the drug found entry into academic medicine. Based on a work by the American physician John Stearns entitled Account of the Pulvis Parturiens, a Remedy for Quickening Childbirth. The use of ergot as an ecbolic did not, however, endure. The great danger for the child that lay above all in the uncertainty of dosage, which when too high led to uterine spasm, indeed became known early. From then on, the use of ergot in obstetrics was confined to the stopping of postpartum hemorrhage, to the stopping of bleeding after birth. After the assimilation of ergot into various pharmacopoeias during the first half of the 19th century, the first chemical work toward isolation of the active principles of this drug began. The numerous researchers that concerned themselves with this problem during the first 100 years did not, however, succeed in identifying the actual substances having the therapeutic activity. In 1907, the Englishmen Barger and Carr were the first to isolate an active alkaloid preparation which they named ergotoxin, because it produced more of the toxic than therapeutic properties of ergot. This preparation was not homogeneous, as I was able to show 35 years later, consisted of three single alkaloids. Nevertheless, the pharmacologist Henry Dale discovered for ergotoxin, besides the uterotonic effect, an antagonistic activity on adrenaline in the autonomic nervous system, important in the therapeutic use of ergot alkaloids. Only in 1970, Professor Stoll isolated the first chemically pure alkaloid, which he named ergotamine, and which found widespread use in therapeutics as a uterotonic agent and in the treatment of migraine. At the start of the 30s, a new era of ergot research began. It began with the determination of the chemical structure of ergot alkaloids in English and American laboratories. By chemical cleavage, Jacobs and Craig of the Rockefeller Institute in New York succeeded in isolating and characterizing the nucleus common to all herbal alkaloids, which they named lysergic acid. An important development, as much from the chemical as medicinal perspective, later brought the isolation of the specifically deuterotonic hemostatic principle of ergot, which was published simultaneously by four institutions, independently of one another, among them the Sandoz laboratory. It concerned an alkaloid of comparatively simple structure, which was water soluble, and that was named ergobasin by the Basel group, ergometrin by the English researcher, and finally ergonovin by the International Pharmacopoeia Commission. By chemical degradation of ergobasin, Jacobs and Craig obtained lysergic acid and the amino alcohol propanolamine as cleavage products. I set as the first goal of my research in the ergot field the problem of preparing this alkaloid synthetically through chemical linking of the two components of ergobasin, namely of lysergic acid and propanolamine. The lysergic acid necessary for these studies had to be obtained by chemical cleavage of some other ergot alkaloid. Lysergic acid proved to be a rather unstable substance, and its bonding with these basic radicals posed difficulties. In the technique known as Curtius synthesis, I ultimately found a process that proved useful for combining lysergic acid with amines. With this method, I produced a great number of lysergic acid compounds. By the combination of lysergic acid with propanolamine, a compound was obtained that was identical with the natural ergot alkaloid ergobasin. That was the first synthesis, that is, artificial production of an ergot alkaloid. This was not only of scientific interest as confirmation of the chemical structure, but also of practical significance, because ergobasin is present in ergot only in very trifling quantities. With this synthesis, it became possible to convert the other alkaloids existing abundantly in ergot to the valuable pharmaceutical preparation ergobasin. Please, next slide.
I attempted to improve the pharmacological properties of ergobasin by variation of its amino alcohol radical.
After the here you see the left side. After this first success in the ergot field, synthesis of ergonovin, my investigation progressed further in two directions. First, I attempted to improve the pharmacological properties of ergobasin by variation of its amino alcohol radical. Together with my colleague Dr. Bayer, a process was developed for economical production of propanolamine and other amino alcohols. Indeed, by substitution of the propanolamine contained in ergobasin with the amino alcohol butanolamine, that is only one methyl group more on the radical up on the right side. That is butanolamine. It's a homologue of propanolamine. By this way I obtained an alkaloid that even surpassed the natural alkaloid in its therapeutic properties. This improved ergobasin has found worldwide application as a dependable uterotonic hemostatic remedy under the trade name Metrogin, and is today the leading medicament for this indication in obstetrics. I further employed my synthetic procedure to produce new lysergic compounds, from which, on the basis of their chemical structure, other types of pharmacologic properties could be expected. The 25th substance in this series of synthetic lysergic acid derivatives was lysergic acid diethylamide, abbreviated as LST25 for laboratory usage, which I first produced in 1938. I had planned the synthesis of this compound with the intention of obtaining an analeptic, that means a circulatory and respiratory stimulant. Such stimulating properties could be expected for lysergic acid diethylamide because it shows similarity in chemical structure to the analeptic already known at that time, namely to nicotinic acid diethylamide, to coramine. The structural formula you see on the right side. You see that the ring, the upper ring of LSD, of lysergic acid, corresponds to nicotine, to nicotinic acid. Coramine. During the testing of LSD-25 in the pharmacological department of Sandoz, whose director at that time was Professor Ernst Rodlin, a strong effect on the uterus was established. It amounted to some 70% of the activity of ergobasin. Furthermore, it was remarked in the report that the experimental animals became restless during the narcosis. But the new substance aroused no special interest in our pharmacologists and physicians. Further tests were then left off. For the next 5 years, nothing happened with the substance LSD-25. Meanwhile, my work in the ergot field advanced further in other directions. A peculiar presentiment that this substance could possess active properties other than those established in the first investigations and expected induced me 5 years after the first synthesis once again to produce LSD-25 in order to give it again to the pharmacological department for further tests. That was in a way uncommon, as experimental substances, once they had been found uninteresting from a pharmacological aspect, as a rule were definitely stricken from the research program. In the spring of 1943, I repeated the synthesis of LSD-25. This involved, as in the first synthesis, the production of only a few centigrams of this compound. In the final step of the synthesis, during the purification and crystallization of lysergic acid diethylamide, in the form of a tartrate, that is a salt of this tartaric acid, I was interrupted in my work by unusual sensations. I take the description of this incident from the report that I wrote at the time to Professor Stoll. Last Friday, April 16, I was forced to interrupt my work in the laboratory in the middle of the afternoon and proceed home, as I was seized by a peculiar restlessness combined with a slight dizziness. At home, I lay down and sank into not unpleasant, intoxicated-like condition that was characterized by an extremely stimulated imagination. In a dreamlike state, with eyes closed, I found the daylight to be unpleasantly glaring. An uninterrupted stream of fantastic pictures of extraordinary plasticity with intense kaleidoscopic-like play of colors surged in upon me. After some 2 hours, this condition faded away. The nature and course of this peculiar experience aroused the suspicion that it resulted from an external toxic influence, and I surmised the connection with the substance with which I had just worked, namely with lysergic acid diethylamide tartrate. However, I could not imagine how I could have absorbed some of this material, since I was accustomed, because of the known toxicity of ergot substances, to meticulously knead work. But possibly a bit of the LSD solution had contacted my fingertips during recrystallization, and a trace of the substance could have come to be absorbed through the skin. In the event that LSD-25 had been the cause of the described incident, then it would have to be a substance of extraordinary potency. With the objective of getting to the bottom of this, I decided to carry out a self-experiment. In order to be cautious, I began to experiment the experiment with the smallest quantity with which a definite effect could just barely be expected, namely with 0.25 milligram lysergic acid diethylamide tartrate. The following is a description of this experiment from my laboratory notebook. April 19th, preparation of a 0.05% aqueous solution of lysergic acid diethylamide tartrate. 5 milligrams of air-dried crystalline tartrate was dissolved in 10 cc of water. At 1620, 0.5 cc of the solution containing 0.25 milligram tartrate was taken orally. The solution was completely tasteless, like pure water. At 1650, still no trace of any effect. At 17, slight dizziness, restlessness, unable to concentrate, thoughts, visual distortions, desire to laugh. Here's a note in my laboratory journal, C's. The last words could be written down only with great effort. It was now already clear to me that LSD had been the cause of the remarkable experience of the previous Friday, for the altered perceptions were of the same type as before, only much more intense. Only with the greatest difficulty could I still speak intelligibly. I asked my laboratory assistant, who was informed of a self-experiment, to escort me home. On the way home by bicycle, an automobile was not available at the moment. During wartime, automobiles were available only to privileged people in Switzerland. During riding home, my condition began to assume threatening forms. Everything in my field of vision wavered and was distorted as if seen in a curved mirror. I also had the sensation of being unable to move from the spot. Nevertheless, my assistant later told me that we had traveled very rapidly. Finally, however, we arrived at home still safe and sound, and I was just still capable of asking my companion to summon our family doctor and to ask for milk from the neighbor. In spite of my delirious, bewildered condition, I could think clearly and effectively for brief periods. I thought of milk as a non-specific antidote for poisoning. The dizziness and sensation of fainting became so strong at times that I could no longer hold myself erect and had to lay down on the sofa. My surroundings was now transformed themselves in more terrifying ways. Everything in the room spun around, and the familiar objects and pieces of furniture assumed grotesque, mostly threatening forms. They were in continuous motion, animated, as if impregnated by life, by an inner restlessness. The neighbor woman who brought the milk, as scarcely recognized any longer. She was no longer Mrs. R., but rather a malevolent, insidious witch with a colored mask. Even worse than these demonic transformations of the outer world were the alterations that I perceived in myself, in my inner being. Every exertion of my will to put an end to the disintegration of the outer world and the dissolution of my ego seemed to be wasted effort. A demon had invaded my being, had taken possession of my mind, body and soul. I jumped up and screamed in order to free myself from him, but then sank down again, powerless on the sofa. The substance with which I had wanted to experiment had vanquished me. It was the demon that scornfully triumphed over my will. A dreadful fear grasped me that I was becoming insane. I was taken to another world, another place, another time. My body seemed to be without sensation, lifeless, strange. Was I dying? Was this a transition? At times I believed myself to be outside of my body and then perceived clearly as an outside observer the complete tragedy of my situation. I had not even taken leave of my family. My wife had traveled that day to visit her parents in Lucerne with our three children. Would she ever understand that I had not experimented thoughtlessly, irresponsibly, but rather with utmost caution, and that such a result was in no way foreseeable? My fear and despair intensified not only because a young family should lose its father prematurely, but also because I thought of having to break off unfinished my work as a research chemist, which I meant so much for me, in the midst of fruitful, promising development. Also, reflection emerged, full of acrimonious irony, that I was to be compelled now to leave this world behind prematurely through the effort of lysergic acetylamide that I had brought forth into this world. As the doctor arrived, the climax of my despairing condition had already passed. My laboratory assistant informed him about my self-experiment. As I myself was not yet able to formulate coherent sentences. He perplexedly shook his head after I had attempted to refer to my supposed mortally threatened bodily condition, for he could ascertain and no normal symptoms other than an extremely dilated pupils. Pulse, blood pressure and breathing were normal. He therefore prescribed me medicaments. He conveyed me to my bedroom and watched over me on my bed. Slowly again I returned from a weird, unfamiliar world to familiar, everyday reality. The horror softened and gave way to a feeling of fortune and gratitude. Some more normal perceptions and thoughts returned, and my assurance increased that the danger of insanity had conclusively passed, that I would come again to life, because I had really did not know if it ever, as it ever would end, if it was the end. Now I gradually began to enjoy the unprecedented colors and plays of shapes that persisted behind my closed eyes. Kaleidoscopic-like, fantastic images surged in on me, alternating, variegated, opening and then closing themselves in circles and spirals, exploding in color fountains, rearranging, hybridizing themselves in constant flux. It was particularly remarkable how every acoustic perception, such as the sound of a door handle or a passing automobile, became transformed into optical perceptions. Every sound generated a vividly changing image corresponding in form and color. Late in the evening, my wife returned from Lucerne. Somebody had informed her by telephone that I had sustained a mysterious breakdown. Leaving the children behind her, with her parents, she had traveled home forthwith. I had by now already recovered myself sufficiently that I could relate what had happened. Exhausted, I then slept and woke the next morning refreshed, with a clear head, even though still somewhat tired physically. A sensation of well-being and renewed life flowed through me. Breakfast tasted delicious and was an extraordinary pleasure. When I later walked out into the garden in which the sun now shone after a spring rain, everything glistened and sparkled in fresh light. The world was as if newly created. Yes? Louder. Speak louder. All my senses vibrated in a condition of highest sensitivity that persisted for the entire day. This had been the first planned experiment with LSD, the first LSD trip, a rather dramatic one. Subsequent experiments on volunteer colleagues of the Sandoz Research Laboratories confirmed the extraordinary activity of LSD on the human psyche. This showed that the effective oral dose of LSD is about 0.05 milligram. In spite of my caution, I had chosen for the first experiment 5 times the average effective dose. I was aware that LSD, a new active compound with such properties, would have to be of use in pharmacology, in neurology, and especially in psychiatry, and that it would arouse the interest of concerned specialists. But at that time, I could not imagine that the new substance would later also come to be used beyond medical science in the drug scene as an intoxicant. Since in my first self-experiment, I had experienced LSD in its terrifying demonism. I could not imagine that this substance could be ever used, so to speak, as a pleasure drug. Also, the meaningful connection between LSD experience and spontaneous visionary experience I recognized only later after further experiments, which were carried out with lower doses and with a different set and setting. That is the story of the discovery of LSD It's a shortened fashion. And now I come to the second part of my talk, LSD experience and reality. The question is often put to me, what has made the deepest impression on me in my LSD experiments, and whether I have arrived at new understandings through these experiences. Of greatest significance to me has been the insight that I attained a fundamental understanding out of all my LSD experiments, that what one commonly takes as the reality, including the reality of one's own individual person, by no means signifies something fixed, but rather something that is ambiguous, that there is not only one, but that there are many realities. One can also arrive at this insight through scientific reflections. The problem of reality is indeed, and has been from time immemorial, a central concern of philosophy. It is, however, a fundamental difference whether one approaches the problem of reality rationally, with the logical methods of philosophy, or if one obtrudes upon this problem emotionally, through an existential experience. The first planned LSD experiment was therefore so deeply moving and alarming, because everyday reality and the ego experiencing it, which until then I had considered to be the only reality, dissolved, and the unfamiliar ego experienced another unfamiliar reality. And the problem also appeared of an innermost self that, unmoved, was able to record the external and internal transformations. Reality is inconceivable without an experiencing subject, without an ego. It is a product of the exterior world, of the sender, and of a receiver, an ego that receives the input by means of the antennae of the sense organs and brings it into consciousness. If one of the two is lacking, no reality happens, no radio music plays, no picture screen the picture screen remains blank. If one continues with conception of reality as a product of sender and receiver, then the entry of another reality under the influence of LSD may be explained in that the brain, the seat of the receiver, becomes biochemically altered. The receiver is thereby tuned into another wavelength than that corresponding to normal everyday reality. Since the endless variety and diversity of the universe correspond to infinitely many different wavelengths, depending on the adjustment of the receiver, many different realities, including the respective ego, can become conscious. These different realities, more correctly designed as different aspects of the reality, are not mutually exclusive, but are complementary, and form together a part of the all-encompassing, timeless, transcendental reality in which even as an unimpeachable core of the conscious self that has the power to record the different egos is located. In the capacity to shift the wavelength setting of the receiving self and thereby to evoke alterations in reality consciousness lies the true importance of LSD and related hallucinogens. This ability to allow different new pictures of reality to arise, this truly cosmogonic power, makes a cultish worship of hallucinogenic plants as sacred drugs by so-called primitive societies understandable. What constitutes the essential characteristic difference between everyday reality and the world picture experienced in LSD inebriation? Self and the outer world are separated in the normal condition of consciousness in everyday reality. One stands face to face with the outer world, which has become an object. In the LSD state, the boundaries between the experiencing self and the outer world more or less disappear, depending on the depths of the inebriation. Feedback between receiver and sender takes place. A portion of the self overflows into the outer world, into objects. They begin to live, to have another, a deeper meaning. This can be perceived as a blessed or as a demonic transformation, imbued with terror, proceeding to a loss of the trusted ego. But in an auspicious case, the self feels blissfully united with the objects of the outer world and consequently also with the fellow man. This experience of deep unitedness with the exterior world can even intensify to a feeling of the self being one with the universe. This condition of cosmic consciousness that under favorable conditions can be evoked by LSD or by another hallucinogen from the group of Mexican sacred drugs is analogous to spontaneous religious enlightenment with the Unio Mystica. In both conditions that often last only for a timeless moment, a reality is experienced that exposes a gleam of the transcendental reality in which the universe and self, sender and receiver, are one. Gottfried Benn, the German writer, in his essay Provoziertes Leben, Provocative Life, characterized the reality in which self and the world are separated as the schizoid catastrophe, the occidental entelechy neurosis. He further writes, this concept of reality began to form in the southern part of our continent. The Hellenic European principle of combat, of conquest, through work, artifice, malice, talent, force, Greek in the manner of Arete, late European in the form of Darwinism, and the overman fashioned it decidedly. The self came forward, stepped down, struggled. For that purpose it required means, matter, might. As Gottfried Benn formulates it in these sentences, a concept of reality that separates self and world has decisively determined the evolutionary course of European intellectual history. Experience of the world as matter, as objects, to which man stands opposed, has produced modern natural science and technology, creations of the Occidental mind that have changed the world. With their help, man has subdued the world. Its wealth has been exploited in a manner that may be characterized as plundering. And the sublime accomplishments of technological civilization, the comfort of Western industrial society, stands face to face with a catastrophic destruction of the environment, even to the heart of matter, to the nucleus of the atom and its splitting. This objective intellect has progressed and has unleashed energies that threaten all life on our planet.